Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Each spring, MIT Technology Review puts out its list of the 10 biggest breakthrough technologies. And every year, we check that list to see how many they've been covered on Word of Mouth. We're happy to report another strong affinity. And here to recap 12 months' worth of amazing and useful scientific advances is Brian Bergstein, deputy editor of MIT Technology Review. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Virginia.
So let's start with word of mouth's all-time favorite topics, which is robots. Many of us have seen these wild demonstration videos out of the lab at Boston Dynamics. But for listeners who have not, tell us a little bit about the company and what they are doing that got them on the list of your breakthrough technologies.
Yeah, so robots have started to make their way into certain kinds of settings. People might be familiar with robots on assembly lines in factories, let's say. But for robots to be much more useful in places that humans can't or won't go, like let's say into disaster recovery areas, they're going to have to walk around. They're going to have to adapt to their environment, detect their setting, and be flexible both in terms of how they see the world and in how they maneuver. And so robots from Boston Dynamics and a few other companies are beginning to have this capability. They actually can balance themselves dynamically, which is something that we do as we walk. And so this is the difference between a robot in a factory assembly line, which is programmed to just sort of do one thing over and over again, essentially just maybe have an arm that swivels around. These robots would be ones that you could send into earthquake relief efforts or situations like the Fukushima nuclear cleanup, where it was too dangerous for humans to go in, but you might want to send machines.
So you've just talked about a big distinction between an existing technology and a breakthrough. So what is a breakthrough technology for you and your editorial board? And I ask, because amazing as these robots are, they don't look like they're going to be ready for practical use anytime soon.
Right. So if I can borrow a famous phrase used in a different context, innovation and breakthroughs are sometimes hard to define, but you know one when you see it. And that's kind of the case here. We tend to ask big framing questions about any kind of technological milestone or development. Does it solve a big problem, or does it somehow reduce friction in the world, or does it create a new way to use technology? If it may not in the short term solve a problem, it might over the long term create a new platform, perhaps, on which other people can continue to make developments. And so the walking robots is an example of that. A fundamental milestone has been reached with robots that can essentially walk about on 2 feet. It's so far from being used in the field, as you say, but other people will continue to develop on that very important development.
Here's something that has been used. Many people said that it would change the world for some time now. That's 3D printing. So what are the latest breakthroughs in 3D printing, and where are they coming from?
So 3D printing is often talked about as this revolution in manufacturing or in home design or home fabrication. And there's definitely been some use of 3D printing or additive manufacturing, as it's sometimes called, in big industrial settings. But for most of us, there isn't necessarily a huge use case for 3D printing, other than for hobbyist kind of work. We're a long way away from you making something at home rather than buying it, for most things. But some really interesting work is happening at the microscopic scale, essentially. We're talking about 3D printing that doesn't just use plastic as the feedstock and as the material that's being built up. So there's really interesting work at Harvard and Princeton and Cambridge, a few other places, where researchers are using multiple materials, not just plastic, and in fact not plastic, to create objects at a micro scale. So, for example, you could imagine an artificial organ that has blood vessels already coursing through it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could imagine a device, electronic device, with the battery already embedded inside. So as the 3D printer head comes through, it layers multiple materials, not just one, and combines both form and function in the same unit.
Some of the items included on your list are not technically new, like the Oculus Rift virtual reality goggles, for example, or drones, though you highlight them being used for agricultural use. What is the significance of these innovations on things that we've already heard about?
So one thing that we're often doing when we're citing something as a breakthrough or an important milestone is we're saying some threshold has been passed. So there has been virtual reality before, there have been drones before, but in the case of both of these technologies, they've fallen below a fundamental price point that is going to make them far more useful to a certain kind of consumer. What I mean by that is there have been drones, and obviously we're familiar with that in the military context, and there have been little choppers and planes that you would fly around for fun, but there's a new set of automated aircraft that are being sold as particularly useful for farmers who can send them up over their fields, use sensors on board the drones for all kinds of readouts of information from their fields and determine where they actually do need water or pesticide, for example, and then hopefully use a lot less of either. So the idea in agriculture is always to increase output while keeping input the same or even decreasing it. And so if more farmers can use drones rather than some other kinds of sensing technologies, they might be able to use fewer resources to harvest their crops.
We're getting a little lesson in what makes a technology a breakthrough technology with Brian Bergstein. He's deputy editor at the MIT Technology Review, which just put out its annual issue highlighting the 10 biggest breakthrough technologies of the year. Brian, last year we did a segment on Silent Circle. That's a company that offers encryption apps designed to prevent third parties from snooping on texts and phone conversations. Tell us more about this growing trend of encrypted consumer-level technology and why it made the list.
Well, you were very much ahead of the game to be reporting on Silent Circle. I think that what we're thinking we might see is even broader recognition and understanding of the kinds of privacy technologies that companies like Silent Circle offer. In the past year, with all the leaks about the NSA and all the ways that the government, in addition to companies in the private sector, can track you, more and more people are going to want, by default, some of the privacy-protecting measures that only the most sort of, let's say, paranoid or technologically sophisticated have wanted in the past. And it's sort of the zeitgeist of our time, perhaps, is to turn more privacy-protecting and to be a little bit more thoughtful about just how much information about us is slipping out from our phones and our devices all the time. And so Silent Circle is teaming up with other companies to produce a smartphone that has encryption and all kinds of privacy-protecting measures turned on by default, so you don't have to go out and fix these settings or download apps that keep your information private. The phone does that on its own.
Well, given as so much brain research going on the past couple of years, it makes sense that there is an item included, a project to map the brain in your list of technology breakthroughs. I was a little surprised, though. Isn't that something that had been done years ago?
Certainly. I mean, I think we're all familiar with those old maps that show like the brain divided up into those dotted line sections, right? From, I don't know, maybe early in the 20th century or even earlier than that. Mapping the brain has gone on as long as people have been studying the brain. But what we're able to do now is to understand the brain structure in far, far more detail. Everybody's brain is different. You're not going to have a universal map. But there are technologies emerging that show individual structures of the brain down to 20 microns, 20 micrometers. This is essentially almost neuron level scale. And what we're able to do is those regions of the brain that you've seen on those old maps, there's probably many, many, many more functional regions that we're going to develop a much better understanding, much more fine-grained understanding of what parts of the brain are involved in much more complex activities than we ever have before.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for letting us know what's going on in the world of technology. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Bergstein, deputy editor at MIT Technology Review. You'll find a link to more items, photos, video, and a lot more details on the 10 breakthrough technologies of 2014. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Chatting up the local barista may not only be polite, but it could alter your mood for the better. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to talk to a psychologist who studies the benefits of interacting with strangers.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As children, we are told not to talk to strangers. And as adults, many of us still abide by that rule. It is made easier with headphones in our ears as we ride public transportation, or screens to look at in the checkout line, or an easy pass to zip through the tolls with nary a how do you do. With the world becoming more socially insular, could we be missing out on interactions that could surprise or even delight us? Talking to strangers may be good for your health, says Elizabeth Dunn, an associate professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's also co-author of the book Happy Money and co-wrote an article called Hello, Stranger, for the New York Times. Elizabeth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So a good place to start researching strangers is on public transportation, where everyone is a stranger, surrounded by a stranger. And the unwritten rule pretty much seems to be keep your head down, keep to yourself. Now, you found a study that challenged that rule. Can you explain it?
Sure thing. Researchers at the University of Chicago headed out to a busy train station in the Chicago area, and they asked commuters to either just kind of keep to themselves, sit in solitude, as so many of us often do, or to mix things up a little bit and actually talk to the stranger sitting next to them during their train ride that morning. And what they found was that people were significantly happier at the end of their train ride if they actually took the time to talk to the person sitting next to them rather than sitting in solitude.
So people were willing to talk back with them?
Yeah, and that's one of the surprising things. I think many of us feel like, you know, the people around us who are immersed in their smartphones or reading the paper don't want to talk. But interestingly, not a single person in the study was snubbed in their attempt to make conversation.
How about on airplanes? I mean, I'm probably not the first person who's noticed that somebody sort of rolls their eyeballs when they think they've got an empty seat next to them. Suddenly someone's sitting with them. And you don't necessarily want to engage in conversation because it might have to last for 6 hours worth of flight.
Right. I mean, I remember quite distinctly one time I was on a plane and there was no one sitting next to me. I had a lot of work to do. And then this huge guy got on and came over and sat next to me and proceeded to spend the entire time talking to me on this flight. But he actually turned out to be an ultimate fighter. And it was one of the most interesting conversations I've ever had with a person that I normally would never, ever encountered in my daily life. So I think even when we don't feel inclined to talk to somebody sitting nearby us, it can actually result in really positive experience.
Well, okay, then we're moving on from commuters to relationships, which you're talking about, more specifically your own. Now, you did an experiment with your boyfriend, Benjamin. What can you tell us about that?
Well, when I was a graduate student, I noticed that my boyfriend, Ben, would sometimes get in a little bit of a bad mood. And if he was around me, he would just kind of act cranky, knowing that I, as his longtime girlfriend, would put up with his negative mood. But if we happened to bump into a stranger or casual acquaintance, Benjamin would perk right up and he'd act pleasant and cheerful, as you have to around someone you don't know well. And what I noticed was that acting pleasant around someone he didn't know well often got him out of his bad mood. So, you know, one person does not make an experiment, but it did provide the inspiration. And so I decided to bring dozens of long-term romantic couples into the lab. And what I found is that most people show this Benjamin effect, whereby they'll act more pleasant around someone they don't know, have never met, compared to how they act around their own romantic partner.
Well, I guess what the Benjamin effect says is that strangers, not necessarily the people closest to us, can perk us up. This is something one of your students, Jillian Sandstrom, tested. Can you tell us a little bit about her study?
So my student Jillian had the insight that the sort of random players, the bit players in our daily lives, might actually matter quite a bit for our happiness. So to get at this, my student and I gave people two little clickers to carry around with them all day, one red, one black. They clicked the red clicker when they interacted with someone they didn't know well. They clicked the black clicker when they interacted with someone they did know well, someone close to them. And then at the end of the day, they just reported the numbers on their two clickers as well as completing some measures of happiness. What we found was that, as you'd expect, people felt happier on days when they had lots of interactions with people they were close to. But more surprisingly, people also felt happier on days when they had more interactions with people they didn't know well. And in fact, the strengths of those effects were very similar. So people got just as much of a happiness boost from interacting with those they didn't know well as they did from interacting with people close to them.
Very interesting. And you and Jillian tested that again at Starbucks. Tell us about that further study.
Well, we conducted a study at a busy urban Starbucks. We went up to people just as they were approaching, and we told some people to try to really have a social interaction with the cashier at Starbucks, to smile, make eye contact, have a little bit of conversation. And we told other people, just be efficient. You know, get in, get out, get your coffee. That's it. Try to avoid unnecessary conversation. And then on people's way out from Starbucks, we measured their happiness and their sense of belonging. Now, you might think interacting with a cashier at Starbucks, that's pretty trivial. It's not going to have any impact on well-being. But in fact, we found that people were significantly happier when they came out of Starbucks if they'd taken the time to have that little social interaction with the cashier. And perhaps even more remarkably, they felt a greater sense of belonging in their communities when they took the time to have that little interaction rather than just getting in and getting out with their coffee.
So maybe not as efficient, but better.
Right. And interestingly, I mean, I'm one of these people for sure who rushes from one thing to the next. I love efficiency. It's sort of the title of our article is Efficiency Overrated? And it's almost a joke between me and my graduate student because I am all about efficiency. Like I schedule meetings back to back. I rush in and out with my coffee. But in fact, what this research suggests is that, saving those few extra seconds by cutting out a social interaction may be a bad trade-off when it comes to our happiness.
Elizabeth Dunn is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's been studying talking to strangers and interacting with strangers and what it actually does for us. It turns out pretty good. How about introverts versus extroverts? Does any of the research you looked at apply to both types of people?
I think many people have the intuition that for extroverts, social interactions are good. And sure, if you're extroverted, then interacting with, the barista at Starbucks or the random guy at the dog park is going to make you happy. But introverts sometimes say to us, well, it's a different story for me. Those social interactions are too taxing for me. They don't make me happy. I'd rather keep to myself. One of the fascinating findings in our research is that when we asked people to carry clickers around all day and keep track of their social interactions, we found that introverts and extroverts alike felt happier on days when they had more social interactions with people they didn't know very well. So this suggests that introverts might actually underestimate the benefits that they really get from interacting with other people.
And it doesn't even require a conversation. It can be just a look.
As little as a sort of fleeting glance seems to make a difference for people's well-being. In a fascinating study, researchers on a large Midwestern campus sent a college-aged woman around campus, and she either made eye contact with people she passed or looked past them as though she was looking through air, sort of as though they weren't there. Mm-hmm. And then researchers trailed her and asked the people who'd been passed by this woman how they were feeling. And in fact, this fleeting glance actually made a difference. So people were more likely to feel disconnected from others if someone, this random stranger, had passed them and looked through them as though they were air. So just that quick glance that we give to strangers, that tiny bit of sort of civil respect, actually seems to make a difference for the well-being of those around us.
But it does sometimes cross a line, interactions with passersby, where people can turn into sort of feeling predatory or creepy. Do you have any advice on how to keep these little street corner interactions or subway interactions positive?
There is certainly such a thing as a creepy stranger. So, in fact, in one classic study from back in the 70s, researchers planted somebody on a street corner who actually stared at motorists, and motorists left the intersection very quickly in that version of the study. So staring at strangers is not a good idea. Probably asking people very personal questions isn't a great idea. But, making that little comment about the weather or complimenting someone's shoes or, when you're in the dog park, asking what kind of dog someone has, all of these sorts of things are all very much within the realm of sort of socially acceptable behavior among strangers and can contribute to enhancing people's days.
How about you, Elizabeth, the efficient professor, writing books, writing articles, doing all sorts of things. What have you taken away from the studies? Have you started chatting up strangers?
this research has definitely influenced me. So my graduate student, Jillian Sandstrom, is a hugger. She, like, hugs everyone that she sees. I mean, not people she's never met before, but she'll hug, like, all the people in our department. I am still not a hugger, so it hasn't completely transformed me. But I do think about it. If I'm in a, you know, new city and I'm taking a cab to my hotel, I try to, you know, make a little conversation with the cab driver. And sometimes I end up having an interesting conversation. Sometimes it just, you know, gives me a brief smile. But I do try to adjust my behavior, at least in little tiny ways, to kind of put this research into practice and connect with strangers.
Well, I'm so glad you spoke with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Dunn, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's also co-author of the book Happy Money, and she co-wrote an article called Hello Stranger for the New York Times. You can find a link to read that article and see some of the photographs of people who were strangers suddenly together. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now stay with us for a bitter battle over cochlear implants. Is the growing use of prosthetic hearing devices putting sign language and the culture it supports at risk? That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It wasn't until the 1970s that deafness, long considered a disability, began to be championed as an identity. Then deaf culture, with a capital D and capital C, became something to be celebrated instead of repressed. Now some in that community fear that the growing use of prosthetic hearing devices puts sign language and the deaf culture it supports at risk. If deaf children are given cochlear implants in the first years of their life, they may never learn sign language and never come to embrace and continue deaf culture. It's turning into a pretty vicious battle. There are websites, YouTube videos, and even academic papers dedicated to the so-called cochlear war. Some parents have even called implanting kids a form of child abuse. Others call it nonviolent genocide. Science writer Sujata Gupta tackled this sensitive subject in a long-form article for Matter called The Silencing of the Deaf. Sujata, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You write that most of the hearing world is pretty much unaware of the depth and, I think, breadth of deaf culture. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in deaf culture that a lot of hearing people may not even be aware of.
So I think a lot of people, and my editor included, really don't know that deaf culture has its own sort of poetry. It has its own forms of theater. We've been exposed a little bit, I think, through like Linda Bove on Sesame Street doing a little bit of sign language.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, I mean, I certainly didn't realize that there are plays written specifically for a deaf audience, or that more back in the heyday that there were these traveling theater groups that put on deaf culture shows specifically written in sign language and performed in sign language. I grew up in Rochester, which is where the National Technical Institute of the Deaf is located. So I think I had some sort of base level of familiarity with sign language. But a lot of people I spoke to didn't realize that there are different sign languages all over the world. And then within countries, there are different dialects. And because these communities tend to be sort of isolated, a lot of times it's very hard for a group of signers from one school to understand a group of signers from another school.
Is deaf culture something that people would identify themselves as belonging to?
I think so. Definitely traditionally, I think, or traditionally, not looking that far back, definitely a few decades ago, I think people would definitely have said, yes, I am deaf, I'm big D deaf. Now, from what I've seen as I've interviewed people, it seems a little more loose. And definitely one person I spoke to who identifies as big D deaf also said that there's a movement afoot to sort of get rid of that distinction or broaden it out a little bit.
Why is that happening, you know, with so many people seeming like a flowering of deaf culture on some level? Why is it receding?
I don't know if it's receding as much as I think there's this feeling among some people that the deaf community has been too isolated. and that the definition of deafness has to expand to include people with cochlear implants, or even for a lot of hard of hearing people who have some residual hearing and can speak and operate in a hearing world, they've often felt sort of marginalized by the deaf community. So I think there's this hope that maybe the deaf community can become more inclusive as time goes on.
Mm-hmm. And the cochlear implants or prosthetic hearing devices are a big part of what's sort of dividing the deaf community. This is a decision largely that parents make, whether to use cochlear implants. And representing that side of the story, we do have Christine Reed. She's on the line. She's a mother of a deaf girl named Ellie. And her story plays out prominently in your article. Hi, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. I want to know from you, most hearing parents of deaf children do choose cochlear implants, but you and your husband really debated whether or not to do it. Why?
Well, I'll start by saying that when you first have a child who is diagnosed as deaf, the first thing that doctors will tell you is, you know, she's deaf, but we can fix that. She can get cochlear implants and she'll be able to hear. And it's just kind of like that's the first option thrown at you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a pro-choice woman.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to make the decision to do something to my child's body, mm-hmm. that wasn't, you know, I think it would be different if it was a life-threatening issue. It was something I didn't want to do. I didn't think that was right. And how can I sit there and tell my daughter that, like, you're perfect just the way you are, but we went ahead and did this to you when you were a child. And that's something that my husband and I both really struggled with.
So what did you end up doing?
Initially, we found the one deaf school in Massachusetts that really focused on ASL. She'll actually be graduating in a few weeks from this program and starting preschool. And we were immersed and surrounded by deaf adults, deaf parents, deaf professionals, deaf teachers. We let her be who she was, and we decided initially that we did not want the cochlear implants. We did some very intensive ASL ourselves, my husband and I.
And ASL is American Sign
American
Language?
American Sign Language, yep. And we had classes sometimes up to 4 times a week just so we could give our daughter her first language like any other parent does.
A lot of people may think, like as you struggled with, you know, cochlear implants fix the problem, my child will be able to hear, at least in some fashion. What's the benefit to your mind in American Sign Language over that?
First of all, even getting cochlear implants, we would have had to wait at least a year. And then at that point, that's when they start their quote-unquote hearing age. So my daughter, she was implanted. We did end up implanting her when she was just about 2. So now she, even though she's almost 3, her hearing age is that of about a 10-month-old. That's a lot of time that we would have missed out and a lot of growth for her. Starting preschool with no language, that's a really, really tough situation to put any child in. So it was important for her to have a language that she can utilize.
I want to go back to Sujata for a moment because, Sujata, you point out in the article that cochlear implants are not, quote, a cure for deafness. Tell us about some of the limitations.
The limitations definitely vary depending on when you get them. So for a child like Ellie, for Christine's daughter, and for a parent like Christine, who's really invested in making sure that Ellie learns to both speak and sign, they're probably going to learn to speak fairly well, you know, if all goes according to plan. When you're talking about adults who get implants, it can be much more challenging, even though the YouTube video seemed to suggest that there's like this miracle cure that you suddenly can be part of the hearing world. In reality, your brain has sort of wired without a spoken language, and so it's very hard to learn to speak that late in life. One of the big limitations that I saw is if you put adults with implants in a very crowded, noisy situation, they'll often struggle to understand what you're saying.
That's the science writer Sujata Gupta. We're speaking about how the growth of cochlear implants is perceived as a threat to deaf culture in general and sign language in particular. Christine is also with us. She's a mother of a deaf girl named Ellie, and her story plays out prominently in an article by Sujata Gupta. What I'm not hearing here is what a contentious issue this is. And it's something I read in the article quite clearly. I mean, I'm wondering about for you, Christine, do you feel like you are put in a position or you have been put in this position where you have to defend your decision about what you and your husband decided with Ellie?
I won't allow myself to be feeling like I have to put in a position to defend myself. Several times in our parent group, when I had numerous deaf parents in with us. The recurring problem, so to speak, with parents implanting their children is the notion that this is a fix and that your child being deaf is wrong. They didn't have any problem with parents getting cochlear implants so long as they allow their children to realize that they are deaf and they are always going to be deaf and this isn't going to fix this. Where I met Sujata at a cochlear implant convention, several of the children with cochlear implants, when they were asked, are they deaf? And they say, no, they're not deaf. And, well, you know, yeah, you are. You have to be deaf to get the cochlear implants. And so they may not be proud of their deaf identity, but it's certainly not something to keep from your child. And I'm not going to defend my decision any more than I would defend circumcising my son or what religion I raise my children. I don't think it's anybody's business.
Mm. First of all, do either of you know which percentage of deaf children are being given cochlear implants at this point?
So it's a really hard statistic to come by, just because I don't think we keep full track of these things. I think there's a statistic from 2000 showing that just above 50% of children in the U.S. are receiving cochlear implants. Many more are actually eligible. If you look at it globally, it depends on what kind of health care the government provides. So in countries in Scandinavia, like Denmark, the implant rate is close to 100%.
100% of those who are born with some hearing disability.
Who are eligible for cochlear implants mm-hmm. will be given implants.
I'm wondering if there might be a possible growth of a new type of deaf culture from the growing population of people who do have cochlear implants.
I think it's possible, and I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's sad. I know a lot of parents that I know personally who have implanted their children who have opted not to go the ASL Big D deaf route. You know, their line of reasoning is, you know, if this is what they want to do when they're adults, then that's fine. They can choose to do that. Like a religious situation, well, we're raising them this way, but, you know, when they get older, they can choose what they want to do. Mm. But it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be mutually exclusive. And just because you learn ASL and you teach your child ASL does not mean you lose them to a deaf culture.
Sujata, I can't help but feeling by the end of your article that you think implants, very understandable choice for individuals, but a cultural mistake nonetheless. Am I reading that right?
I wouldn't know if I'd call it a cultural mistake, but I would say that it's really a confusing place. Christine's absolutely right. You do what you think is best for your child. I think if you're a deaf parent, implanting your child or not, it's a pretty hard decision because you want to make sure that they stay in your community. I think as a hearing parent, most hearing parents, Christine and Derek, are so unusual from what I've found in the weight they gave to deaf culture as part of their decision when they chose to implant Ellie. And, you know, you just said that there's this hope that maybe deaf culture can evolve to include children with cochlear implants. Certainly, without a question, it can evolve to include a child like Ellie, who's fluent in ASL. But when you're talking about the huge number of children who are now being raised without ASL, who may want some access to the deaf community, I think that's where it gets very murky, because if you let that community in, then what happens to a culture that's so grounded in language? And I maybe that my own confusion showed by the end of the article, because I don't really have an answer to that, and I don't know that anyone does. I don't think anyone knows just what will happen to deaf culture as time goes on.
Christine, you want to add something?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I just wanted to add on to what Sujata was saying, too, is, you know, because of this article, I received a very lovely email from a deaf man who went to Gallaudet and 20 years ago had wrote a scathing paper for one of his classes about cochlear implants. And basically, you know, hearing parents who implant their children should be charged with child abuse. And he said that he felt so awful that he wrote this paper, and he apologized. And, you know, I kind of just said, this is how you felt at the time. You can't apologize for that. But like, as Sujata wrote, culture, a huge part of culture is language. And if you don't have that language, you know, what ties that culture together, or how do you get along in that culture? I don't think any culture is sitting there saying, no, you can't come in because you have cochlear implants, as a culture at large. Certainly there are still individuals who do feel that.
Yeah, I would have to say that would be my read of some of this deaf culture, you know, where you're not welcome.
But the other side of the coin is, in our particular school that we go to, 47% of the children from 1 year old all the way up to sixth grade, 47% of these children have cochlear implants. Well, if you don't want these 47% in your group, in your kids' culture, you're likely not going to have a deaf school. that's just the sad reality of it. They do need these kids with cochlear implants, or else they don't have the resources to run these schools.
Well, Christine, I'm going to stop you there, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christine Reed, she is, among other things, the mother of a deaf girl named Ellie, and her story plays out prominently in an article by Sujata Gupta, science writer, and our other guest. Sujata, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, she wrote a long-form article in Matter called The Silencing of the Deaf, and you can find a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. These days, hearing a new musician you're curious about is as easy as clicking on Spotify. In the mid-19th century, not so much. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to go back to 1850 to find out why wealthy Americans were shelling up to $250, a staggering amount back then, to see a singer they had never heard before. Listen for yourself when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 21st century, music lovers have it easy. You want to vet a new musician? Spotify it. Want to hear your favorite song over and over and over? Just press repeat. Want to see your favorite artist get into an altercation on an elevator? Just visit TMZ. In the mid-19th century, before the advent of recorded sound, music lived and died in the performance space. Back in 1850, wealthy Americans were willing to pay top dollar to hear the voice of Jenny Lind just once. Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace brings us the story.
In 1994, maybe it was 95, I was in a band, and it wasn't very good. And that was largely my fault. And we were playing a show in a living room in Santa Cruz, California. It was all very punk rock. And the first band was playing while I paced around in the hallway, nervous, because I knew my mediocre drumming was what kept us from being a good band. In the opening act, playing in the living room, were two women, and a guitar and a snare. It was all very punk rock. And while I was out there in the hallway, they played a song that just killed me. It was simple and confessional, and their voices were lovely. I bought a tape from them afterward. And a few days later, the tape deck in my car ate it, the way that tape decks in your car used to do. And I lost the song. And I looked for it for years, in every record store, and I never found it. And then I forgot about it. But the other day I was tooling around on my computer, and I Googled it, and there it was, the same exact version, uploaded from the cassette. It took all of a minute and a half. And then I was, for a moment, in the living room on Galt Street, and I could see the punk rock kids sitting on the floor like it was story time at the library. I could see the friends I had wished I'd kept in touch with, and the ones I was better off without. All because of the sound of a snare and a guitar and the voices of two 19-year-old girls. Now, I know this is a whole lot of preamble, but there is a point, and it's a simple one, but it is one that kills me. Before the advent of recorded sound, you heard something once, and that was it. You heard a song. Maybe you could buy the sheet music. Maybe you could pick out the tune on your banjo or the piano in your parlor. And maybe you could conjure up some sort of approximation. But you heard something once, and that was it. There are no existing recordings of Jenny Lind. She died in 1887, at 67 years old, just after the first recording devices were invented. There's some evidence that she sang for Edison in his studio right before her death, but the recording is lost if she did. And it does seem that we're missing out. People who know these things tell us that Jenny Lind was the greatest singer of the 19th century, the greatest white singer in the white Western canon. People said she sounded like an angel, or silver, or spun silk, or like a bird perched high in a thin branch, or a nightingale. people today, historians, opera buffs, whomever, sometimes call her the first rock star. But I won't. A rock star is someone you can hold in your hands and lie on the floor with when you put on your stereo with your headphones on. Someone you can watch over and over on Ed Sullivan or MTV or on YouTube or Vimeo. Jenny Lind wasn't a rock star. She was a firefly. She would flicker for a moment and then vanish and be gone. And such was the desire to see her glow that she sold out concerts at the biggest opera houses night after night for months on end, year after year. And in 1849, this success caught the eye of a man who said he had no ear for music. P.T. Barnum came to London and made Jenny Lind an offer. He would pay her $170,000 if she would come to America and perform 170 shows. And that was a fortune at the time. He had never actually heard her sing. He didn't care, because he knew she could sell tickets. Jenny Lind arrived in New York on the 1st of September the following year. 40,000 people lined the docks to greet a singer they had never heard sing. Tickets to her first set of American concerts were sold by auction. The cheapest seats went for about $250, meaning that it cost roughly the average middle-class income in America at that time just to get in the building. But the wealthy of the New World happily shelled out for the chance to hear, just once, the reigning voice of the Old World. And in lieu of a CD or a box set or a download or an uploaded cell phone video or a cassette sold out of the back of a car after a show, they bought tchotchkes, Jenny Lind curios, Jenny Lind waistcoat buttons, Jenny Lind porcelain dolls, handkerchiefs, gravy boats. Anything that could remind them of what they heard once. And the people outside the theaters, the people who couldn't afford to get in, were swept up too. P.T. Barnum made sure of that. He played the press, feeding them true stories of Lind's charity and chastity and religious piety. And America loved their superstars chaste and pious. Even then. Jenny Lind sailed back to England 2 years later, with more than $350,000 to show for her efforts. She arrived in London a conquering hero. Her first return engagement was a concert for the Queen, who had spent 2 years aching to hear her again. All told, Jenny Lind performed 93 times in North America on that tour. But there's one specific concert I want to leave you with. There were only so many cities a Swedish opera star could play in America in 1850. There were only so many appropriate venues. There were only so many well-heeled music aficionados. There were only so many cities. And it was hard to get from one to the other. So Jenny Lind and P.T. Barnum and her orchestra and entourage sailed from South Carolina to the Gulf of Mexico, stopping off for shows in Havana, before settling in for a 13-night run in the Grand New Concert Hall in New Orleans, Louisiana. Now, the closest major city was Memphis, 400 miles up the muddy Mississippi, several days' journey by riverboat, several days during which P.T. Barnum wouldn't make a dime unless he found somewhere else for her to perform. On a warm winter's night in 1851, a few hundred people crowded into a Methodist church that sat high on a hill above the river in Natchez, Mississippi. The town's few wealthy citizens, the plantation owners, sat in the pews, dressed up for a night at the opera, which was a type of night that most of them had never had before, and that none of them could have ever expected to have right there in the Delta. And in the last rows, and standing in the back, and squeezed onto benches up in the rafters, were the shop owners, and the men who ran the docks, and the women who hung linen, many of them European immigrants whose lives had somehow led them here to the middle of nowhere, far from home, and the music and the sounds they'd left behind. And for an hour, once, Jenny Lind, accompanied by a single piano, because there was nowhere for the orchestra to sit inside the small church, sang songs some of them hadn't heard since they'd left home, and others had never heard before, and that all of them would likely never hear again. Jenny Lind sang, and then she was gone.
That's Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace. You can find the entire story on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we thank you so much for joining us today. Unlike the opera stars of the mid-19th century, Word of Mouth can be heard anytime you'd like. If you missed any part of this show or would like to share it with a friend, simply visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. After all, we find that the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Plenty more coming your way tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.